Good evening and welcome to this extended Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's show, we'll have a short excerpt from the question and answer section of the presentation by Extremely American Podcast co-creator Heath Druzin of Boise State Public Radio. The United Church of Moscow put on the program at the 1912 Center in Moscow this week, attended by about 200 people, with Druzin, whose podcast second season is called Onward Christian Soldiers, which focuses on the increasing power of Christchurch pastor Doug Wilson of Moscow and some of the abuse stories. We'll also hear from the Idaho State Board of Education's meeting this week, where they voted to ban any offices or programs that deal with equity, inclusion, and diversity on college campuses, with a couple of carve-out exceptions. And we'll also hear from the Pullman City Council, which decided Tuesday they are not inclined to pursue a resolution calling for an Israel-Gaza ceasefire. But first, world headlines from FSN, followed by a roundup of regional news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nick Harper. The US government is perilously close to shutting down for the first time in almost 6 years, as lawmakers struggle to pass a deal that would keep funding flowing. The deadline to approve a deal is midnight local time on Friday, but after a vote failed in Congress on Thursday night, Capitol Hill looks no closer to consensus, as FSN's Benji Hire reports.
The art of the deal? Well, now's the time for Donald Trump to live up to his famous book title. After tanking a funding package that had enough votes to pass, the president-elect has just hours left to avoid causing a government shutdown. But here's the problem. Dozens of representatives from his own Republican Party don't support Trump's suggested deal, which allows for the debt ceiling to be raised before he takes office. And the previously proposed deal, backed by Democrats, that's now dead too, after being torpedoed by Elon Musk, who's railed against increased government spending. Members of Congress must now regather and agree on some stopgap measure by the end of Friday, or else federal agencies will start to grind to a halt without the money they need to function.
US President Joe Biden is set to meet Pope Francis at the Vatican in what is likely to be his final international trip as the Commander-in-Chief. Biden will also meet with Italian government leaders during the journey in early January. FSN's Mitch McCann reports.
The president will visit Italy between the 9th and 12th of January, only days before he finishes his single-term presidency. Mr. Biden accepted an invitation from Pope Francis to visit the Vatican after a phone call with the Pope earlier this week, according to the White House, which added that the pair will discuss efforts to advance peace around the world. Biden is the second Catholic U.S. president and has met the Pope before several times, including at the Vatican in 2021. While in Italy, the Prime Minister, Giorgio Meloni, and President Sergio Mattarella will also meet with Mr. Biden. According to the Associated Press, official visits this late in a U.S. presidency are not typical, reporting that the last president to travel overseas in the final month of his presidency was George H.W. Bush.
UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer has chosen a former Labour Party communications director and ex-government minister to be the next ambassador to the United States. The expected appointee, Lord Peter Mandelson, worked with former Prime Ministers Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. Ever since Lou Brown reports.
Peter Mandelson, who also served as a European Union commissioner, is likely to be the next ambassador as soon as next month, ahead of US President-elect Donald Trump taking power. The appointment signals a change from normal procedure in the UK, as ambassadors tend to be civil servants rather than politicians. The British government, though, says it wants someone with experience, crucially on the issue of trade.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Rural communities across Massachusetts are benefiting from state grants aimed at strengthening the local food supply and building climate resilience. State officials have awarded nearly $4 million to help farmers improve soil health, upgrade irrigation systems, and prepare for extreme weather events, including the current critical drought conditions. Department of Agricultural Resources Commissioner Ashley Randall says farms are helping the state meet its ambitious climate goals.
They're a mitigation and resilience strategy so that farms can be best positioned to withstand the changing weather conditions that they're facing.
Randall says grants will help farms improve efficiency and environmental controls and reduce greenhouse gases. Massachusetts has set a goal of reaching net zero emissions by 2050. From cranberries to oysters, the majority of farms in Massachusetts are smaller, family-owned operations. Randall says grants will help farmers purchase high tunnels and other equipment needed to extend their production season. She says that helps secure jobs and provide income to local economies during the winter months.
All of these grants are really helping to ensure that we have a stable food supply and to continue to grow and adapt should there be climate change impacts like we saw last year that devastated the sector.
Last year, a deep freeze in February spoiled the peach crop, while a late frost in May damaged most tree fruits. Significant flooding last summer severely damaged some 13,000 acres, resulting in more than $65 million in losses. Randall says farms face often unpredictable factors, but grant programs can help them adapt and thrive in the face of uncertainty. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
When the Champlain Tower South collapsed in Surfside in 2021, taking 98 lives, it sent shockwaves across South Florida. The tragedy has left lingering questions about the safety of coastal high-rises and whether the ground beneath them is as solid as once thought. A new study by scientists from the University of Miami uncovers a troubling pattern. 35 buildings along the coastline from Miami Beach to Sunny Isles Beach are sinking, some at rates of up to 8 centimeters in the past 7 years. Lead author Farzana Aziz Zanjani calls the findings significant.
We saw a correlation between the start of the subsidence and the nearby construction activities, and we also found some correlation between the geology. So as we move from Sunny Isles to Miami Beach, the amount of subsidence is less.
Using satellite-based technology, the team tracks subtle ground movements that are otherwise invisible. Sunny Isles Beach, known for its luxury high-rises, showed the most dramatic rates of subsidence. The researchers believe the southern Florida geology, softer sandy layers within the limestone, may be a factor. For longtime residents, the study is unsettling. The idea that some buildings may be sinking in a region already grappling with rising seas and stronger storms adds concern about the future. But Aziz Zanjani cautions against jumping to conclusions.
Doesn't necessarily mean that these buildings are unsafe. This is beyond the scope of the study we had. It just shows that there is something happening under these buildings, and it's related to geology and a lot more factors that we don't understand and we need to do more research.
The research was motivated by the Surfside collapse, but scientists found no evidence that subsidence contributed to that tragedy. Still, Aziz Zanjani says the study highlights the need for transparency and better monitoring of structural stability across the region. Aziz Zanjani's paper is open access to the public. This is Tramel Gomes for Florida News Connection.
Three environmental nonprofits filed suit Wednesday against the California Air Resources Board to oppose the expansion of a program that allows oil and gas companies to offset their pollution by buying credits from huge farms that produce natural gas from animal waste. Last month, the state amended the low-carbon fuel standard to expand credits that favor biogas, arguing that it removes methane from the waste stream and creates renewable power. But Tyler Lobdell, a staff attorney with co-plaintiff Food and Water Watch, says the program is actually a perverse incentive for factory farms to get bigger.
The biggest operators, the biggest polluters are the most rewarded, and that is the incentive structure here. Go out and be as big and as polluting as possible, and you will see the largest reward from our program.
The low-carbon fuel standard is intended to reduce carbon pollution by incentivizing the transition to clean cars. The lawsuit argues that the credit program prioritizes pollution-heavy practices over sustainable solutions. Lobdell notes that manure only produces methane when large quantities are liquefied at these concentrated animal feeding operations. He suggests the state require factory farms to manage their manure in ways that don't rely on anaerobic environments that emit methane.
The real solution is to reduce the pollution, not to monetize it and lock it in for generations. We should be requiring these facilities to more sustainably manage their waste. That would have climate benefits. That would also have benefits to local air quality and to local water quality.
The lawsuit asks the court to require the California Air Resources Board to disclose, analyze, and mitigate the environmental impact caused by the change to the low-carbon fuel standard. The other two plaintiffs include the nonprofits Defensores del Valle Central para el Aire y Agua Limpio and Animal Legal Defense Fund. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
North Dakota is expected to rejoin the debate over whether all school children, regardless of their family income, should have access to no-cost meals. Universal lunch programs have been adopted by nearly 10 states, including neighboring Minnesota. A broad coalition of organizations gathered Thursday to push for adding North Dakota to the list. The federal government funds free or reduced-cost meals to income-eligible students. States with universal policies cover the remaining expenses so all kids eat free. Michelle Wagner of the North Dakota School Nutrition Association says working in a school cafeteria has opened her eyes about the need.
As a food service director, we see firsthand that many of these students depend on school meals as their primary source of nutrition.
The coalition says one in three North Dakota children relies on the Great Plains Food Bank, and many don't meet school meal eligibility requirements. North Dakota lawmakers temporarily boosted meal eligibility last session, but advocates say wider permanent access is needed. A likely bill sponsor says there appears to be bipartisan support, but expects pushback over cost concerns even with a budget surplus. Coalition members argue this type of move works as a tax cut, estimating North Dakota families would save more than $850 per child each year. Robin Nelson of the Boys and Girls Club of the Red River Valley says by putting kids in a better position to learn, the state also would be able to address workforce shortages down the road.
If I were a company that was trying to recruit employees, I would use this for anybody to move to the state.
Statewide polling in North Dakota has shown strong public support for expanded school meals. In Minnesota, policy observers say that state's program, approved in 2023, is proving to be popular, but demand has been strong, elevating costs. Those behind North Dakota's efforts say they hope lawmakers get a full scope of what's needed when they begin debating the issue. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
This month, an Arizona grand jury indicted two out-of-state residents for cheating the state's Empowerment Scholarship Account program out of more than $110,000. Now critics of the ESA program believe Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tom Horn's latest decision, could open the door to similar problems. The Republican-backed ESA has grown in popularity, leading to a backlog of reimbursement requests. Horn recently decided to approve all requests of less than $2,000. Beth Lewis with Save Our Schools Arizona says accurately reviewing these 85,000 transactions will be a challenge.
My skepticism is rooted in, you know, the history of the program under Horn the last couple of years. So I don't think anybody really has hope that there will be actual accountability. But what's even worse is this sets a really dangerous precedent going forward.
Lewis acknowledges many Arizona families use the program as intended, but that isn't guaranteed. The Department of Education says its new auditing system will work to detect suspicious activity in ESA accounts. Horn says approving tens of thousands of these payments will significantly diminish the backlog of requests. Lewis says this year's state budget stripped funding from public schools and higher education and fully funded the ESA voucher program. She says Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs and Democrats were unable to work with the Republican-led majority on the issue of adequately funding public schools and hopes more can be done next year.
I worry that we're going to see a lot more school closures and staff layoffs, teacher layoffs, and other, you know, funding cuts this year. I know the Arizona voters support our schools, and I really hope that we can start to see maybe a space of a little bit more bipartisanship around Prop 123, for example.
Funding for Proposition 123 comes from the State Land Trust, which needs voters' approval to be directed to K-12 education. Hobbs has announced her Prop 123 renewal plan to increase teacher compensation and improve school safety. While it has garnered some bipartisan support, policymakers haven't reached a consensus on all the details. Funding is set to expire in July 2025. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Earlier this month, partners from the firm Holland and Hart gave a presentation for Idaho employers preparing for more federal immigration and customs enforcement audits and undercover agents in the workforce leading to deportations. One of the partners said they are preaching a philosophy of paranoia because of the expected sharp increase in deportations from the second Trump administration. According to the Idaho Press, partner Chris Thomas said, "We're preaching a philosophy of paranoia here. It's time to assume every conversation is retrieved. This is what they do, whether through infiltrated agents or people who have been threatened by deportations." A 2021 University of Idaho McClure Center report put the number of undocumented immigrants in Idaho that year at 35,000. The report says 86% of those were working in agriculture, hospitality, and construction, and those who work are paying income, sales, and other taxes, while at the same time being ineligible for public assistance, such as SNAP or Medicaid. Employers are bracing for big impacts from Trump deportation policies, which will likely displace workers and potentially break up families. Idaho Dairymen's Association CEO Rick Nairbout said at the December 12th meeting, "If you remove the 30,000 unauthorized workers in Idaho, I mean, look at our unemployment numbers. There's not workers waiting to take these jobs. This is far greater than just Idaho's dairy industry that could be significantly damaged by mass deportations and mass removals." Idaho's unemployment rate was 3.7% in October. Thomas said immigration and custom enforcement agents will try to entrap employers by telling them they are here illegally to see if they are willing to knowingly employ someone who is undocumented. He said, "So here's rule number one. If you have the weird conversation, please create Exhibit A in your defense and just say, 'We did not know you were here unlawfully, and unfortunately, that means today's your last day.'" The other Holland and Hart partner giving the presentation, Dean Bennett, emphasized protecting employers. Bennett said, "It's hard when you have an employee who's been with you for 15 years and maybe you realize something about it. Realize this is for your individual protection and the company's protections. And as much as you want to help someone who may have three kids to support, has nowhere else to get a job, it sounds bad, but yourself and the company probably come first." Trump's deportation policies are at least tinged with racism because they are aimed at the mostly mestizo part of the undocumented workforce, who are North American citizens descended from indigenous people. Idaho's Republican Governor Brad Little is grabbing onto the Trump coattails. On December 11th, he signed a statement along with 25 other Republican governors supporting Trump's proposal to deport undocumented people en masse. The statement said the states are, quote, "ready to utilize every tool at our disposal, whether through state law enforcement or the National Guard, to support President Trump in this vital mission." During this year's legislative session, Republican Representative Brent Crane of Nampa introduced a bill to create the crime of illegal entry into the state of Idaho by a foreign national and to provide civil immunity and indemnification of local governments and state officials, employees, and contractors who enforce the law. House Bill 753 passed in the House 53-15, but did not advance in the Senate. Nairbout said the dairy industry has been lobbying for years to have access to a legal worker visa program. Because dairy work is not seasonal, the industry is not eligible for the H-2A visa temporary agricultural worker program. The McClure Center report in 2021 showed the agriculture industry in Idaho, which is seasonal, increased the use of H-2A visa programs by 63% between 2016 and 2021. The report notes the H-2A program requires employers to prioritize authorized U.S. residents when hiring, and goes on to say the increase suggests authorized workers' interest in seasonal agricultural positions is not growing with workforce needs. Thomas said employers contracting with staffing agencies can create liabilities for them because authorities have found some staffing agencies are illegally compelling labor by threatening workers with deportation. He called the practice really nasty, dark stuff, but we are seeing it way too often lately. Nairbout said the national consequences of a massive deportation program could be large. He said, you can't remove 50% of the on-farm workforce without removing the U.S.'s ability to feed ourselves. And that's really the risk. That's bigger than just dairy. It's bigger than just Idaho. And we're only talking about agriculture. You and I aren't talking construction or hospitality or services or medical or any other aspects of the economy that are equally dependent on this workforce as agriculture. Former Boise Police Chief Ryan Lee has taken the job of Baltimore Police Department Chief of Detectives. Lee worked with the Portland Police Bureau for 20 years and was Boise Police Chief for 2 years. Boise Mayor Lauren McClain asked Lee to resign in September 2022 after a series of internal accusations against the police chief. In 2021, he injured an officer while demonstrating a vascular neck restraint on him during a training session. Boise police had banned the vascular neck restraint following the 2020 police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. The Idaho Press reported at the time 20-year Boise police veteran Sergeant Kirk Rush had said he required surgery to repair discs in his neck after Lee used the chokehold on him during the demonstration. The Idaho State Police contracted with the Clearwater County Sheriff's Department to investigate the training injury, and after several months, the Clearwater County Sheriff's Department announced there would be no criminal charges against Lee. Then in early 2022, 9 Boise police officers alleged Lee engaged in verbal abuse. A leaked City Office of Police Accountability memo said Lee should be suspended without pay while investigators looked into the verbal abuse complaints. The day after the memo became public, Mayor McClain asked Lee for his resignation. Lee resigned, but later sued Sergeant Kirk Rush after a law firm's investigation into racism in the Boise Police Department found there was an internal campaign to remove Lee, who is Asian American. The investigation came about when then-current police officer Matthew Bringelson was slated to speak under a pseudonym to a white supremacist group at the New Century Foundation American Renaissance Conference in Burns, Tennessee, before investigators discovered a YouTube video of Bringelson speaking of his plans to address the white supremacist conference. A news release by Baltimore Police Commissioner Richard Worley earlier this month said, Chief Ryan Lee is an experienced leader, and we are grateful to have him serve with the Baltimore Police Department and City of Baltimore. He brings significant and relevant experience to addressing the challenges in policing. Lee will be taking on a critical role for the department as we continue to drive historic reductions in violent crime and rebuild trust with the communities we serve. The Idaho Department of Lands announced Tuesday it will distribute a sum of $63 million to Idaho public schools later this school year. The Idaho Press reports the total lands department allocation to Idaho programs will be $103 million this year. The State Endowment Fund Investment Board manages the Department of Lands endowments, which come from timber sales and other income from the 2.5 million acres of endowment land under the purview of the Lands Department. Idaho Department of Lands Director Dustin Miller said in a news release there is currently $3.3 billion in the endowment fund, which would cover their beneficiaries' programs for about 7 years in the event of an economic downturn. Miller said, because over half of the beneficiary distributions come directly from land revenue, mainly timber harvests, the endowment fund continues to grow and support future generations of beneficiaries. It is important to have both the endowment fund and endowment land working together to generate returns for the beneficiaries. Coupled together, the financial assets and timberland provide reliable and consistent sources of funding for beneficiaries like our public schools. Litigants in the case of Planned Parenthood of the Greater Northwest versus Attorney General Raul Labrador called a status conference last week into a report that the Idaho Division of Occupational and Professional Licenses opened an investigation when someone complained to them that an Idaho medical provider told a patient accessing an abortion out of state was an option. The result of the status conference was the State Board of Medicine and the State Board of Nursing have agreed not to investigate providers who refer patients out of state for an abortion while the courts are considering the case against Labrador. Planned Parenthood Greater Northwest and two doctors sued Attorney General Labrador, State Board of Medicine members, and State Board of Nursing members over an opinion Labrador issued in March 2023 saying providers could be prosecuted under Idaho's felony abortion ban for referring patients out of state. Labrador had quickly rescinded the ruling, claiming it was not valid due to a procedural issue, but Planned Parenthood and the doctors sued anyway, saying state officials might still try to enforce the law because of the Attorney General's opinion. Earlier this month, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals blocked enforcing the opinion while litigation continued. In the same decision, December 2nd, the court allowed enforcement of much of Idaho's so-called abortion trafficking law, allowing the parts against assisting an unemancipated minor to get an abortion out of state without parents' permission to go into effect, but saying the part of the law against advising a minor to go out of state for an abortion would likely violate First Amendment protections of free speech. The Idaho Press reports Department of Occupational and Professional Licenses attorney Russell Spencer confirmed in a December 13th court filing that a nurse practitioner informed a patient she could go out of state to get an abortion, and the patient got very upset and filed a complaint. Spencer wrote the nurse was already under investigation for another issue. He wrote the investigation that the Department of Occupational and Professional Licenses is currently pursuing against the licensee pre-existed the abortion referral complaint, and while information learned from the new complaint may bolster the pre-existing investigation, it is not based on the abortion referral. Attorneys for Planned Parenthood and the two doctors filed for the emergency status conference because of Attorney Spencer's words that the new complaint may bolster the pre-existing investigation. The notice for the status conference said, in light of this information, on December 13th, counsel for plaintiffs reached out to counsel for the boards to see if the parties could enter into a stipulation that would turn counsel's reassurance into something durable and enforceable. A filing on Wednesday of this week says attorneys for the medicine and nursing boards and the plaintiffs have agreed to be bound to not take action against providers who allegedly violate the abortion ban, and in exchange, the plaintiffs would drop the two boards as defendants in their lawsuit. The judge in the case must grant the motion in order for the court to enforce the terms of the agreement. Idaho's extreme abortion law, making it a felony for medical personnel to perform an abortion on a fetus, embryo, blastocyst, or zygote, punishable by up to 5 years in prison, has been in effect since June when the U.S. Supreme Court sent that case back to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal. The Idaho purports a civil law allowing family members, including grandparents, parents, brothers, and sisters of a person who has an abortion or the father of a person who is aborted in Idaho, can sue abortion providers. That's also in effect. However, with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in June to punt the case back to the Ninth Circuit Court, the High Court effectively reinstated an injunction against enforcing the part of the Idaho abortion law impacting emergency physicians who otherwise would not be allowed to perform an abortion in order to save the health of the mother rather than the life of the mother, which is one of the narrow exceptions in Idaho's total abortion ban. The other exceptions are for rape or incest with a police report. You're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
Community radio is all about building community.
Well, you know I have a love for everyone I know.
In a world built to kill us, survival is a radical act, so donate today.
And you know I have a drive. To live, I won't let go.
In these turbulent times when the focus is on survival, KRFP will bring you the news and entertainment that will help you survive. In these dark times, KRFP will aspire that nobody who is marginalized or under attack will be abandoned or silenced. Your donation will help guarantee that independent voices are still available on the airwaves. KRFP is always focusing on community building.
If you received a KRFP end-of-the-year fundraising letter, quickly open it, read how we are here to build community, and then donate to keep our all-important 1100-watt FM signal on the air.
Don't be afraid to donate. You will reap benefits in the form of community engagement that will change your life forever. You can also find the KRFP fundraising letter at www.krfp.org.
And you're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. Amazon, which is under a strike action this week for failing to negotiate with unionized employees, has proposed building four modular nuclear reactors at Hanford. Amazon is offering $334 million for a multi-year feasibility study for their cluster of modular reactors. Energy Northwest Energy Services and Development Vice President Gregory Cullen told the Washington State Journal Amazon is partnering with his company. Cullen said the modular nuclear reactors would be owned and operated by Energy Northwest and would provide 320 megawatts to the Northwest's power grid, with the option of expanding the cluster to 12 nuclear reactors producing 960 megawatts. The U.S. Department of Energy has announced a grant to Inland Power and Light to purchase enough solar and wind power to provide electricity to 22,750 homes. The Empowering Rural America grant comes under the Federal Inflation Reduction Act. Federal officials say the government spending will create over 450 short- and long-term jobs, stabilize costs to rural cooperative members, and reduce climate pollution by 477,000 tons each year. They also say the Energy Inland Power and Light Company will receive will reduce greenhouse gas pollution equivalent to over 111,000 gasoline-powered cars annually. Inland Power plans to use the grant money to purchase the renewable energy and for supporting student agricultural and tribal programs in the region. The utility plans to launch a battery storage pilot program aimed at medical necessity, low-income and residential members in high wildfire risk areas to increase resiliency. Inland Power CEO Jason Bronek said Inland Power sustained rapid residential load growth every year since 2017, which is expected to continue. The power purchase agreement is a proactive step in ensuring reliable, sustainable, and affordable power supplies for years to come. The Idaho Transportation Board has approved $200,000 in spending to start studying replacement options for Long Bridge on U.S. Highway 95 just outside of Sandpoint, the 1.5-mile north-south crossing of an arm of Lake Pend'Oreille. Is currently served by two parallel bridges, one built in 1956 and the other in 1981. Only pedestrians and cyclists are currently allowed to use the older bridge because of its age. The Transportation Department has done previous studies which recommend the bridges be replaced with a single four-lane traffic bridge with shoulders and separated bike and pedestrian lanes. Transportation Department District Engineer Damon Allen said in an ITD press release, "Up until now, we have been performing maintenance projects to delay replacing this expensive structure until it reached 100 years old. But as we've looked to widen US 95 south of town, we've heard from the public that they want us to look at this sooner rather than later." The money will allow staff to begin preliminary planning and pursue grant applications for design. This study will start next year, and there will be a goal of seeking grant funding to finish the study and design. The department says initial cost estimates for building just the northbound part of the bridge with a separated bike lane would be at least $225 million. Between 2019 and 2023, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad built a second railroad bridge nearby, which crosses the same arm of Lake Pend'Oreille. The two parallel railroad bridges are just under a mile long, heading out over the water from a different part of a peninsula jutting into Lake Pend'Oreille. The north end of the railroad bridges and the vehicular bridges meet on a jetty near downtown Sandpoint. Bonner County Sheriff Darrell Wheeler has temporarily tendered his resignation for 30 days in an attempt to claim retirement benefits while continuing his full-time employment as sheriff. According to the Spokesman Review, Wheeler announced his plan in a Facebook post Monday, which said, quote, "After much prayer and reflection," unquote, he plans to resign as Bonner County Sheriff and file for retirement. He said, "To be eligible to receive those benefits, I am required to be separated from county employment for 30 days. The Idaho legislature changed rules for Idaho's retirement system in 2022 and 2023 to permit first responders to be rehired after retiring. According to the Spokesman Review, former State Senator Scott Herndon of Sagal, who was present when the law was passed, said it was meant to hire experienced people back when there were shortages. Wheeler has drawn criticism from Herndon, who said, despite guaranteed employment by the county, Wheeler is not eligible to begin collecting retirement benefits. According to state statute, if someone in the sheriff's office or police department retires and is rehired during the 30-day retirement window, that person is not considered eligible for benefits because it is not considered a separation of service. However, if the person returns more than 30 days later, he or she would be considered separated from service. Herndon said the law is easy to misinterpret. He said the statute is clunky in that one subsection implies someone like Wheeler cannot be guaranteed employment and receive benefits, while another subsection indicates he could. A Public Employee Retirement System of Idaho spokesperson wrote in an email, "Percy is restricted from disclosing or discussing any member information." The spokesperson also said guaranteed reemployment with regards to bona fide separation is an arrangement between the employer and employee prior to separation. Employers cannot have a guaranteed arrangement with an elected position, as the employer cannot hire or terminate an elected official. Herndon said, it could come to the point where too many people retire than rehire. That's why we built a sunset date. At that point, we will have collected data to see how many people took advantage of that. Wheeler's salary as Bonner County Sheriff is $106,315 per year. The Idaho Transportation Department announced a new property condition and assessment report by the architectural and engineering firm CSHQA, which says renovations to the Idaho Transportation Department's headquarters in Boise will be double the cost of the original amount of money the legislature approved. The cost is now expected to be $64 million rather than $32 million. Court and Transportation Department records say the issue involves the Transportation Department's former headquarters on State Street in Boise, which flooded in January 2022 and subsequently was contaminated by asbestos, displacing all department employees. Transportation officials report crews found mold was growing in the building built in 1961. The Transportation Board declared the 44-acre site as surplus property, which paved the way to sell the campus. However, state lawmakers blocked the $5.7 million sale in March, arguing it is better for state taxpayers to block the sale and remodel the building. Legislators then appropriated $32.5 million for renovation, which was based on a sight unseen estimate by the Division of Public Works. According to the Idaho Capital Sun, the Public Works Division's estimate did not consider the amount of flood damage or heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system repairs. Transportation officials released the 207-page property condition and assessment report, which now estimates the renovations range from the level 1 of $64 million to the level 2 estimate of $69.4 million. According to the report, level 1 estimates provide costs to permit state employees to return to work in a safe, secure, and comfortable workplace which meets state standards. Level 2 estimates include all level 1 upgrades plus a new fire suppression sprinkler system and an open floor plan designed to permit long-term occupancy and adaptability. Architects and consultants note the assessment is not a formal repair bid, which means costs could vary from the recommended amount designated by the assessment. In a phone interview yesterday, Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee co-chair Representative Wendy Horman of Idaho Falls said, "We used the numbers that were provided to us, so it is interesting to see such a large discrepancy between what was provided to us and acted on in good faith during the legislative session and these new numbers." The building has been vacant for 3 years. The Transportation Department gave the Idaho Capital Sun and others a tour of the flood-damaged property. The building has a damp, musty smell. Water damage to floors, walls, and carpeting is plainly visible, according to the Idaho Capital Sun. There are dozens of holes in the interior walls, which work crews drilled to help water drain. Desks, broken wood, and chairs are stacked haphazardly. Electrical wiring is a tangled mess of twisted metal. Would-be buyers include Hawkins Companies, FJ Management, and Pacific West Communities, who all say they planned on demolishing and building a new facility, choosing instead to not renovate the flood-damaged building. And you're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP Radio Free Moscow. Love's Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. For more information, visit loveskombucha.com.
We now turn to our first of three featured segments, an excerpt from the question and answer section of the presentation by Extremely American Podcast co-creator Heath Druzan of Boise State Public Radio. The United Church of Moscow put on the program at the 1912 Center in Moscow this week with Druzan, whose podcast second season is called Onward Christian Soldiers, which focuses on the increasing power of Christ Church Pastor Doug Wilson of Moscow and some of the abuse stories. Here is that excerpt.
We have a few questions from the audience. Can you draw a straight line between the Christian nationalist movement and an authoritarian government?
Yeah. So, I say that not to be flip, but I'm going to try not to like bore you as a history major here, but we've seen it in the past, right? So in Argentina, there was this idea of the sword and the cross back in the 70s, and that was the Catholic Church in league with a dictatorship, and that's a Christian nationalist dictatorship in the not too distant past, where you saw that kind of Christian nationalist authoritarianism. You saw it with Franco in Spain. I mean, it's not so. When I say you can draw a direct line, I mean, yeah, we've seen it in the past. And there's a book that was published by Canon Press, so Doug Wilson's publishing house, very recently, and I read it, so you don't have to. It's called The Case for Christian Nationalism. It's really long, and it's pretty dense. But it's called The Case for Christian Nationalism by Stephen Wolfe. His brother William Wolfe, by the way, was a senior Trump administration official who's very likely to be a more senior Trump administration official. But that book lays out the idea of a Christian prince running the show. That book's really influential in Christian nationalist circles. It is not a treatise on democracy. It literally talks about a Christian prince. So basically like a strong man who's sort of, you know, divinely ordained to lead people. So there's some serious authoritarian strains. And as I said, they don't like democracy, and you don't have to take my word for it. They'll tell you. Just ask them. I guess the answer is yes. Not always, but often.
This is a little longer. Talk about media coverage. What happened to newspapers' traditional role as the fourth estate? Neutral reporting, calling out lies, promoting truth. What has happened to reporting statistics about statements that simply are not acceptable because facts refute them? What do they teach in journalism schools now? What about law?
Well, I wouldn't know because I never went to journalism school, so it's not me. Okay, so, ouch. I think that the thrust of the question is, why is there a false equivalence in journalism today? Like more false equivalence, it sounds like, where you're sort of treating like a wildly radical idea the same as a normal idea. And the one I use is like, women should be able to vote, women should not be able to vote. Hopefully it came across in my podcast that, I want to hear what Christian nationalists have to say, but I'm not going to pretend that taking the vote away from women and telling non-Christians that they can't run for office is like okay, because it's not, because first of all, that's like you know, my daughter, that's me, like my whole family is sort of like covered there, and I don't think we should lose our rights. But it's a problem in journalism for sure. As more radical ideas get mainstreamed and become part of government, there is an unfortunate unfortunate reaction to sort of treat ideas that used to be unacceptable as just another normal opinion. And I think that's dangerous. Now, I also think it's dangerous to just try to ignore these things away, because that hasn't worked. And it won't work. The other thing, I know there were a lot of criticisms in there, and that's fair. We should be open to scrutiny as journalists. The fact is, how many people here subscribe to your local newspaper? All right, okay. You guys are special.
Good crew here.
If you're being honest, thank you. Most rooms will not have that percentage. For listeners at home, the majority of hands went up. That's great, but that is not representative, and it's hard to newspapers don't have resources that they used to. I worked at the Statesman in the mid-2000s, and even then, it felt like we were pinched. Man, that newsroom is a ghost town now compared to when I was there. And so you've got reporters who are doing two stories a day, and it's brutal. Now, I'm not saying that's an excuse for not doing your due diligence, but you can only do so much. You only have so much time. People are underpaid. So we need to find a way. We have responsibility as journalists, but also the communities have. We got to find a way to support better journalism, because it's a real detriment to democracy that local newspapers, especially local stations, just local media in general, has been so decimated.
Thanks.
That's an excerpt from a presentation by Heath Druzan of the Extremely American podcast, which he co-produced for Boise State Public Radio this summer. The United Church of Moscow put on the program at the 1912 Center on Tuesday. Druzan's podcast's second season is called Onward Christian Soldiers, which focuses on the increasing power of Christchurch pastor Doug Wilson of Moscow and some of the abuse stories that have come out of it. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is sponsored by Mikey's Euros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine, such as Euros, falafel, hummus, and tabbouleh, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
KRFP is also sponsored by
Hodgins Drug and Hobby of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hodgins features a pharmacy, educational toys, and hobbies. Hodgins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hodgins at 208-882-5536. KRFP supports progressive values, including multiculturalism and environmentalism.
As a doctor, I've seen too many women with breast cancer who could have avoided extensive treatment or even death had they just gotten an annual mammogram. Every major medical organization experienced in breast cancer recommends annual mammograms for women 40 and older. Please, if you're 40 or older, get a mammogram every year. If you have a family history or other risk factors, talk to your doctor about what's right for you. To find an accredited center, visit mammographysaveslives.org.
And you're tuned to the KRFP Evening Report. We now turn to our second featured segment on this Friday edition. On Wednesday, the Idaho State Board of Education voted unanimously to prohibit diversity, equity, and inclusion programs on college campuses and set a deadline of June 30th for the policies to end. University of Idaho President C. Scott Green, who attended the meeting via video link up, told the board of, quote, a deep sense of loss and sadness on the Moscow campus. The vote means the end of the UI Office of Equity and Diversity, which will have to close. That includes the Office of Multicultural Affairs, the LGBTQA Office, the Women's Center, the Black African American Cultural Center, and the College Assistance Migrant Program. The UI, Boise State University, and Idaho State University plan on replacing the programs with student success centers open to all students, even though the heads of the diversity offices have insisted their services were always open to all students, regardless of identity. During the live stream of the State Board of Education meeting Wednesday, some people typed into the comment section. Some of those comments were, DEI programs are essential to enrollment, retention, and growth of universities' student bodies. Ask the taxpayers of Idaho what they want. Serving all students means acknowledging that not all students are coming in with the same cultural needs. One-size-fits-all support is a myth and an assimilation tactic. One of the board's taglines is advocacy. By removing DEI programs, you show that you are not advocating for your students. Those were some of the comments typed into the live stream comment section on Wednesday during the State Board of Education meeting. Recent UI Vice President and Executive Officer for Southwestern Idaho, Mike Satz, who is also Executive Director of Project 97, a statewide organization established to counter extremism in Idaho politics, wrote on Facebook, "The University of Idaho closed its Women's Center, one of the oldest continually running in the country, its Office of Multicultural Affairs, LGBTQIA+ Center, and the Black African American Cultural Center. Today, hate, ignorance, fear, and bigotry won. A tragic day for students, the university, and the state. This is the silence the dissenters phase, for those of you still in denial about what is happening." We now bring you some of the State Board of Education discussion Wednesday, starting with Board Executive Director Joshua Whitworth introducing the resolution for a second time. He had already introduced it on November 21st, although there have been some changes in the last month. That'll be followed by comments by State Board Chief Academic Officer T.J. Bliss, and then later in the program you'll hear from Idaho College presidents and members of the State Board of Education. So here is State Board of Education Executive Director Joshua Whitworth.
First resolution is a resolution on DEI ideology in higher education, and that's gotten the most feedback as we've talked through these over the last few weeks. The second resolution is a resolution on governance in higher education, and the third resolution is a resolution on freedom of expression in higher education. These have gone through the board's normal kind of process. We've introduced them for discussion. We kind of participated in a lot of debate and different actions through the various components of our subcommittees, and then iterated on the final resolutions that you all see in front of you. That includes some discussions even outside of what would be our normal process with legislators, with community members, and also with our institutional's presidents and some of their students and staff that don't always engage directly in these discussions. And I think, you know, my personal representation of that is these are hard discussions. These are very intimate components of information that people have focus and emotional connection to some of the outputs that come around, whether it's diversity, inclusion itself, or other ideas of equity. So, as we've had these discussions, it's important to remember that empathy as we talk through the components of what this is and what that means to the population of students and faculty and other components of our community that see these as important. But I also say there's multiple sides of this, but there are groups on either side that would look at DEI ideology and see that as very disruptive and probably in some instances the political action of it driving communication that is not supportive of how we treat our students and create a welcoming environment. So through this, and TJ will talk about some of the specific instances of change, but you'll see a focus on in the definition change of the first resolution to DEI ideology. And through many of the discussions we had around this, trying to focus a definition of what we're talking about. And I think as he talks through many of the changes, an important component of understanding is these are not intended to separate the importance of diversity in the state. And you'll see that there's been components added that having a diverse groups are important, just like in business. Having diversity of thought around a boardroom that allows debate is important. But having it be a driving force and swinging of momentum that forces groups to attain to a political thought process is really what we're talking about. So the second component of that is also defining what DEI ideology is. And we talked about this last time. That is something that has been nebulous, both nationally and locally. And even our legislature has struggled to define what that is. And so the team, in discussions with the universities and faculty and provosts and others, have come up with a definition here that I'll have TJ read. But essentially, that the difference from personal identifiable characteristics of decision-making over top merit. And I'll have TJ read the specifics and do that. So as you debate this, please know that that's one of the specific changes that is us trying to focus on the things that divide our institutions rather than unite them in defining this. There's been a lot of feedback. We've gotten comments from a survey that the students that the university set out to make sure we got feedback. We had about 687 comments come back from our students. About 10% of those in support, about 9% of those are generally not interested, have other components of interest that were brought, and then about 80% in opposition to varying degrees of opposition, but in opposition to the resolutions. As many of you have received, we also received many emails regarding people's interest in this as well. A couple caveats to note. We have 44,000 students in our system, and 687 respondents is about 1.5% of our population that have responded to this. That does not negate the importance of those comments from those individuals. As many have read those and we evaluated what they mean, the importance of those comments are real and how they impact. And I think as we've kind of thought through a lot of this, another component of this that is super important to understand is that this is kind of a first step. This is the directive. And the directive also, as you see, the resolutions can have potential policy changes that are in front of the board, as well as how the institutions actually fully implement this going forward. And many of the discussions that we've had around these resolutions also talk about the importance of the students that have experienced this type of activity in the construct of support that they know today versus what might be the focus on a central support function for all students and how that would meet the needs of students in the future. And it's going to be hard for that change for everybody that are currently in the understanding of how they get support today. But the idea here is not to take support away from students, but ensure that is holistic in approaching bringing students all together rather than identity-focused type centers on our campuses, as the resolution states. Another component to think about as we evaluate these is this really sets the authority of the boards over top our institutions and the expectation that the board sets the tone and future of where they believe the institutions should be. And I think that's important to remember as we go through this. We've also received components from our faculty senates, discussions with student leadership, and I personally sat down with student leaders and sought to understand their components and where they are at. As we discuss the intricacies of what these resolutions actually do for providing a framework for a different model of support. It also expressing, I believe, what this board has expressed to me as the importance of ensuring that students have the support they need to be successful. And I think these resolutions provide a framework that provides flexibility, that the guidance that the team has worked with our institutions to define can give the reality of meeting the support of our students at the level that they need going forward. But it doesn't mean that some students won't feel disenfranchised. And as we've heard from some of our presidents and some of our student leadership, that there is some of that that's out there. But that I would argue that that also doesn't make it wrong to make changes and look at how we can do better support on a holistic level and deal with the concerns and activities that we see coming in. So there are a number of exceptions noted in the guidance, and I think it's important for the board in reviewing those. Those exceptions haven't changed dramatically from what we've had previously, but they have been moved into the guidance to ensure that this board can provide the guidance in those gray areas to ensure, I believe, the intent and discussions and what may come out of this is met, not just a letter of law. So that guidance provides the ability for us to make determinations that best support the students and the institutions in their direction, how they lead that. And TJ can go through some of that. Lastly, there are also arguments that have come back that have said that these resolutions don't go far enough, right? Which as we look to make change happen in the world, there are people that say these are just actions that are in name only and don't really address the concerns. I will argue in my experience in working with the institutions and talking through generally their plans that they are working towards, if this is a reality, these are structural changes in support. And I will argue with anybody that says they're not. These is really a philosophical difference of how we deliver support around our students that our institutions are looking at as an output of these potential resolutions being passed. And I think that reality that people want to just attack our institutions and seek to take money out because they don't see the universities maybe representing that output, I don't think is a realistic argument. And I will defend the institution's efforts that any changes that they do make and what these resolutions represent are substantial philosophical changes in how support is delivered. So with that, TJ, would you walk through the general changes that the board has not seen since the last?
TJ, before you start, I just want every board member to realize that we're going to vote on these resolutions separately.
Madam President, Chair Roach, members of the board, I'm TJ Bliss, the Chief Academic Officer for the State Board of Education. And I'm going to highlight the changes from the first time that you saw the resolutions back in November to the state that they're in now based on the feedback that we've received from the institutions and the community at large. And Executive Director Whitworth has mentioned a couple of these, but I'll reiterate them for emphasis. So the change in the first resolution on DEI ideology is a change of title from Resolution on Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in Higher Education to Resolution on DEI Ideology in Higher Education. The reason for that change is because there's an addition of a directive to define the concept of DEI ideology as any approach that prioritizes personal identity characteristics over individual merit. There's also an addition of a new whereas statement related to the value of diversity in higher education. And there's a replacement of the phrase diversity, equity, and inclusion, or those three words, which are all separate concepts, with the phrase DEI ideology as defined in the resolution throughout. There's also the rewording of a directive in there that student success centers should serve all students, regardless of diversity, equity, or inclusion, to now read in the inverse that no student success centers shall serve students based on DEI ideology. So that the intent of that is still there. And then updated language regarding the exceptions to the requirements in the resolution. This was through a discussion with the IRSA committee about wanting to be able to provide examples, to be able to provide more expanded guidance than would be available to do in the resolution itself. And so I want to walk through briefly the guidance document. It's attachment 5 to this item. So nothing in the resolution prohibits the institutions from taking any of the following actions. And this is a legal analysis that we conducted based on the wording of the resolution itself and existing policy and law. So this is our legal interpretation of what the resolution does and does not do. It does not prohibit the institutions from undertaking non-discriminatory activities, policies, and procedures to support student success, including students at higher risk of completing, of not completing a program or degree. And some of those examples are supporting first-generation students, veteran students, students with disabilities, international students, Pell-eligible students, and transfer students. Another one is it does not prohibit supporting citizens of federally recognized American Indian tribes, including establishing and maintaining a designated center for American Indian students, or supporting American Indian cultural events, or offering or facilitating scholarships for American Indian students. It does not prohibit the institutions from complying with athletic requirements, including NCAA, NAIA, or athletic conference requirements that might involve elements of diversity, equity, or inclusion. It does not prohibit the institutions from complying with any academic program-specific accreditation requirements, like accreditation for nursing programs, for example. It does not prohibit institutions from supporting student clubs or faculty or employee affinity groups, even if those deal with DEI-related issues, political issues, social issues, whatever they might be. And it does not prohibit the institutions from maintaining eligibility for grants and federal programs, or from offering scholarships based on identity, including to American Indian students, first-generation students, or students from historically underserved communities. And finally, of course, it does not prohibit the institutions from complying with any other federal, state laws or regulations, including the Americans with Disabilities Act, or the important one to point out, the Higher Education Act includes a designation for our institutions to become Hispanic-serving institutions. College of Southern Idaho is at NHSI. I believe Boise State is or is soon to be NHSI. So we would want to make sure we call those out. And these are just examples. The bold points in this guidance are the main areas of exceptions, which are reasonable because these are largely things that we don't control. These are things we want to be part of, like the NCAA. If we choose to be part of that, then we're going to have to work within the pluralistic society that we are. And then finally, on the resolution on DEI ideology, we added this to all the resolutions, an implementation date of June 30th, 2025, recognizing that some of these changes are substantive and may take the institution's time to do. Some have begun already. Some have a lot more to do. And we want to give them adequate time. They don't need, think they need to do that tomorrow in all of these. So that's the first one. The other resolutions had...
Them one at a time.
Sure. Yes.
So are there questions first for for you?
TJ.
I can get it out of my mouth. For TJ.
You just heard from Idaho State Board of Education Chief Academic Officer T.J. Bliss, preceded by Ed Board Executive Director Joshua Whitworth. When we come back, we'll hear more from this Wednesday's State Board of Education meeting in Boise, in which the board voted to prohibit diversity, equity, and inclusion programs on college campuses.
KRFP thanks its listeners and supporters, including... The Palouse Folklore Society, celebrating traditional music and dance on the Palouse since 1982. The Palouse Folklore Society sponsors concerts, jam sessions, and a monthly contra dance. Find out more at palousefolk.org or on Facebook.
KRFP is also sponsored by Friends of the Clearwater, a 501c3 environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting your public lands. FOC is defending the wildlands, wildlife, and waterways of north central Idaho for future generations. Friendsoftheclearwater.org.
We now have more from this Wednesday's State Board of Education meeting, in which the board voted to prohibit diversity, equity, and inclusion programs on college campuses in Idaho with certain limited carve-outs. In the next section, we'll hear from board member Kurt Liebig commenting.
Okay, then are there comments that aren't questions, Mr. Liebig?
Yeah. I mean, at the risk of repeating the question I asked at the last board meeting, but I do think it bears repeating again, I absolutely understand why we should be focused on the issues around DEI ideology. I think
on many campuses across this country, the way it has been implemented has created real problems. Whether it's the schools I went to, back east, major issues because of the way it was implemented. I've had four kids go to college on the East Coast. I've seen it there, and so I understand the problem. And there are, and we've as a board identified even in our institutions here in Idaho, times where it has been baked into our institutions, and we took action. So the example of that is where we banned the use of diversity statements in the hiring process. We took that action. But what I want to make clear is I've seen the effects of DEI ideology on East Coast campuses, and that is not what is here in Idaho. It's not. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be focused on it, but we need to keep in mind that we're dealing with, in my mind, a very different issue than like the University of Michigan is or Harvard is or some of these other institutions. And so where I get concerned is the unintended consequences of this action. And so the question I asked at the last board meeting, and I really still haven't heard the answer to it, is if we pass this resolution, what specifically happens on our campus? And in a month ago, I thought, well, the way this would go is we'd approve this resolution and the campuses would then go make the changes. But we've had at least two institutions that have already made the changes or some changes. So I guess my question still remains, and maybe I'll ask it a different way. We need to support all students. So for those institutions that have made changes already, who are we not supporting today after the changes that we were supporting before? I mean, what services have been eliminated that we deem that students don't need to be successful or what? I'm just trying to understand the implication of this resolution. I see all the things it's not going to, you just went through all the things that aren't going to change. I'm trying to understand what is changing. And I don't have a clear, that's my concern.
So Mr. Liebeck, we have all four presidents online and others. We have actually some of our community college too. So since this question focused first of all on those of you who have made some changes, we'll start with you and then we'll let the others chime in too. Idaho State President, I assume you're in the room there.
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Would you start, please, in answering his question?
Sure, yes. President Clark, members of the board member Liebeck, thank you for that question. I would answer it this way. We have not done away with programs. What we are doing is we are reorganizing where those programs originate from and who is administering those programs. So, for example, in the programs that were housed within our Diversity Resource Center and our Gender Resource Center, those programs related to student activities, student participation, student engagement are being shifted and moved to our Division of Student Affairs, and more specifically, our Office of Student Involvement, where our student clubs can be directly engaged with engaging in those activities and actually leading those programs. So instead of having offices lead the programs, we are now having our professionals work with student clubs to lead and to administer and to run these activities that are meant to engage our students so that every student who comes to Idaho State University feels welcome and that they feel they have a place. Because we've moved those programs out of those two centers and we're moving the academic support to our new Bengal Success Center that will serve all students academically, it has then meant that we do not need to have those two centers. So it's not doing away with, it is moving. And we are excited. We've talked with leaders of student clubs who are excited about administering and being engaged in these programs and these activities. I think it's a great leadership and mentoring opportunity for our students to be able to have these types of experiences. Since we made these changes and announced them the middle of November, we've had student clubs that have come to us and said how excited they are to be more involved in our recruiting activities, so that when we have students come on campus to consider Idaho State University, it is these affinity student groups that want to be present and want to be available to help the students to feel engaged and feel that they have a place. The other changes that Idaho State University has made is we've renamed our Title IX office to be the Office of Equal Opportunity in Title IX, which of course is mainly focused on federal requirements and implementation of federal policy. So I will certainly say that there are concerns on this campus. I respect that. Our faculty, students, and staff are concerned that members of our institutional community feel welcome and feel that they have a place. And as I've mentioned individually to members of the board, it is now our responsibility, now that we've announced these and we're in the middle of implementation, to demonstrate to our greater institutional community that this reorganization and the way that we are doing it is going to work, so that all students feel welcome, our faculty and staff, they feel that they have a place and they're being engaged.
You just heard from Idaho State Board of Education member Kurt Liebig speaking at this Wednesday's State Board of Education meeting in Boise, in which the board voted unanimously to prohibit diversity, equity, and inclusion programs on college campuses. The vote was widely understood as coming from pressure from the far right of the Idaho legislature. When we come back, we'll hear from the college presidents.
Extinction Rebellion Palouse proudly supports KRFP. XR Palouse is organizing to have our governments and institutions declare a climate emergency, achieve climate justice and biodiversity, and leverage the power of arts and humanities to foster social change.
KRFP is also sponsored by
Idaho AFL-CIO, dedicated to representing the interests of working people at the state and local level. KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors for helping make this programming possible.
And you're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman. This is the extended Friday edition of the Evening Report. Finally, we have another part from this Wednesday's State Board of Education meeting in Boise, in which the board voted to prohibit diversity, equity, and inclusion programs on college campuses in the state, which means the University of Idaho Office of Equity and Diversity will have to close, including the offices under it, the Office of Multicultural Affairs, the LGBTQA office, the Women's Center, the Black African American Cultural Center, and the College Assistance Migrant Program. In the next section of the meeting, we'll hear from Ed Board member Bill Gilbert, who said he was disappointed the two universities, ISU and BSU, moved forward preemptively in banning DEI programs without waiting for a State Board of Education vote. That'll be followed by comments from Boise State University President Marlene Tromp, Lewis Clark State College President Cynthia Pemberton, and University of Idaho President C. Scott Green. Here's Gilbert in his exchange with ISU President Robert Wagner.
President Wagner, I'd like to understand, you know, we haven't actually approved any of these resolutions yet. There has obviously been change over the last month. You know, there could be additional change before we even approve these, depending on kind of where we go today. I think understanding, like to Kurt's point, the intention of where we're trying to go versus the kind of outcomes and implications of these changes, I'd like to understand why Idaho State made these changes in advance of the board coming, you know, passing these resolutions. I think it puts, candidly, the board in kind of an interesting and awkward position that policy isn't dictating then the appropriate response. It's the response, and then potentially I think there's a risk that we're then bringing policy to meet that, which is not the right way to operate from a strategic standpoint. So I'd like to understand the impetus for Idaho State to kind of do this in advance of the board.
President Wagner.
Sure. President Clark, board member Gill, and members of the board, thank you for the question. These actions came after very lengthy deliberations internally as an institution, as well as we've engaged with members of our community, as well as with members of the legislature through our normal government relations efforts. We've spent a lot of time engaging with state leaders over the last 6 to 8 months, again, as part of our regular government relations work. And as we did that, as we received questions, as we heard concerns, we felt like there was an opportunity for our institution to make changes that we could control, to make changes that meant that individuals who care about students and are working very, very hard are not going to all of a sudden lose their jobs at the end of a legislative session. That people who are dedicated to student inclusion and student involvement are going to be able to continue those efforts. So for us at Idaho State, we saw an opportunity to really determine how as an institution we were going to more effectively meet the needs of our increasingly diverse students. I appreciate that the resolution changes now involve more of a focus on first generation students. Board Member Gilbert, we have plans to eventually open a center for first generation students. We've not done that yet. The resolution contemplates and discusses the ability of institutions to be able to do that. We very much appreciate. So some things, yes, we've already done as an institution. Some things within the resolution are things that we were thinking about that we've not yet implemented. But once again, I felt the imperative, and I will take accountability for this as Idaho State University's president, I felt accountability to respond to what we were hearing and what we were seeing, and most importantly, as an institution, to really determine how best we were going to go about meeting the mission that we have in serving students. It was critical for us to be involved in that decision-making process.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I can understand the explanation. However, you know, I think the same thing could have occurred, frankly, through a process. I mean, I understand the sort of the pressure, noise, and potential outcomes from the legislature and or, you know, other constituencies. But, you know, with respect, those constituencies are not the Board of Governors or Board of Trustees for your institution or the other institutions. And I think it's really important that on things of this weight, because this is, Kurt's framed it incredibly well, and I think others have, this is of significant weight, right? It has across all of our campuses for the system as a whole and for all of the students that matriculate in our system. These are exactly the kind of decisions that a board like this exists for, and so that we can do this. And so I think that it's unfortunate and a bit disappointing that was not the process that was used here, because I think that's specifically the point of having a board of trustees like this, or across all of our institutions. I don't know if anybody else would agree with that on the board.
President Clark,
yes,
board.
President.
Yeah, I would just jump in and say, from my point of view, we didn't make these changes in a vacuum. We did it by engaging the public with leaders. I engaged with the board office. If there was ever an impression that this was done outside of the purview of the board, that was certainly not our intention. We also had not received any instruction that we needed to do that before making these changes. So certainly it was not our intention to fall outside the lines. We were We anticipated from a previous legislative session, in fact, two, the questions and the concerns that were being raised. I felt that we'd done it in a public way, in an engaging way, and certainly we would welcome more board involvement with that, and it was not any way an intention on our part to do anything without board approval, but we felt like the engagement that we had was sufficient for us to make the internal institutional decisions that we made.
Responding to Bill's question to the board, I'll add on and agree with his statement on again with respect to what you're saying, President Wagner. We do value all of the external stakeholders, but this is the governing body, and I think for these types of issues, we weigh more heavily than anyone else in this case and in other cases. And so I agree with the points that Bill is making.
Boise State, President Trump.
Thank you very much, President Clark, President Clark, and members of the board. Member Liebig, I want to speak to the issue that you raised initially, which is that it grieves me very deeply that for many years our work to support and serve our students so they can be academically successful has been profoundly misunderstood and misconstrued. I've repeatedly explained that we are dedicated to serving all of our students, and as a result, our Idaho student enrollment has increased by 51.6%, and our four-year graduation rate has increased by 39% in the last 5 years, a profound testament to those commitments. Our students and their families see, understand, and value the Boise State experience. We've seen laws enacted and enforced across the country prohibiting many kinds of student support efforts, and given our state's strong stance on these issues and the reactive disruptions to services for students that we saw on many campuses around the country, we wanted to work thoughtfully with our community to ensure that we continue to serve all students and to create even better student outcomes. We've been working on this for some time, and our board may recall that we spoke about this last summer, and we've been working with board staff over the last 9 months on these issues. We remain committed to making sure that every student knows Boise State is their home. We are committed to serving every rural student, urban student, straight student, LGBTQI student, white student, underrepresented student. We will ensure that people who are sexually assaulted have a place to report and get support. Our desire is to ultimately make services more broadly accessible and to increase engagement. We will continue to assess the impact of any changes on our students and their success. I am gravely concerned that students and community members have felt devalued, which is something that our board has noted. And I want to affirm that we remain committed to each and every one of them, whoever they are, wherever they're from. Our VPSA is out of the office, and I have our Dean of Students with me today, who's available to address any specific or granular questions you may have as well.
Other questions for Dr. Trump?
Okay, well, again, I would ask the same question of Dr. Trump I asked of Dr. Wagner, and that is, there may have been conversations, but again, the impetus for kind of getting out ahead of the policy doesn't make sense to me.
Dr. Trump, do you want to respond?
Thank you, President Clark. Thank you, Board Member Gilbert. We actually had no intention of getting out ahead of the policy. We have been working diligently for many months on this effort and trying to ensure that we've remained engaged with the board office throughout, and that we have really moved on the direction of ensuring that we can maintain stability of our services and not be reactive.
I would just say that maybe this is a
problem that we can address as a board moving forward in the future. But our topic of discussion today really is around the resolution rather than how it all came about. I realize that's a problem for some board members. What I would just ask that maybe we focus on the DEI ideology and the other resolutions and maybe address this topic at another time.
Okay, I would just remind everyone that the original question was, are you able to continue the services under this policy that you have previously had? And that's where we started going to the presidents, which right. is germane to this resolution.
Let me just phrase it maybe a little differently and have the presidents respond. These are such major changes. In my mind, they have to be values-driven decision. And at least for me, I won't put my values on other board members, but I value the diversity in the state, right? That we live in a diverse state. Our campus should reflect that diversity, and we shouldn't be scared of it. We should be embracing it and nurturing it and honoring the great diversity we have in the state. So that's value one. Value two is, I think we need to recognize it, and I know you all do, that every student comes to our campus with a different toolkit to be successful. You know, a kid that grows up in Boise who doesn't need any financial help, has two parents that went to college, has a network of high school kids, and they show up on the Boise State campus. That's a very different situation than a kid from rural Idaho who maybe parents didn't go to school, has a huge financial burden, maybe English is their second language. We've got to be able to support all those students. And you know, that's critical. And then third value is, I don't know when inclusion became a four-letter word, but don't we want every student to show up on our campus and feel like they're included and belong? You know, we call the biggest alumni event homecoming for a reason. We want everybody to feel like that when they step on any of your campuses, that it's a place where they feel we belong. So I guess I'm just looking for assurance from our leaders that this, if we pass this resolution, that it doesn't in any way compromise at least what, at least I view some core values are in terms of how we should manage our institutions.
I'm going to go ahead and let the folks who didn't speak, and then I'll circle back to the two institutions that spoke. Dr. Pemberton, would you like
Thank
to
you. Thank you. Thank you, Board President Clark, members of the board. Our journey has been and likely will continue to be different than our sisters. And that's an artifact or a function of our small size and our limited operational resources. So we, in response to the evolving political climate, evaluated and had conversations with the only sort of identity center on our campus, which really functions for Native American Veterans Student Services. And conversations with that director, we were assured and shown by virtue of student advising data and information that indeed that center serves all students. Even with these resolutions as they're worded now, that wouldn't even be an area of concern based on the resolutions. So for us, we do not anticipate changing our services and supports for students. We do not anticipate that these resolutions are going to impact that. We will continue to be focused on our mission and serving all students and meeting workforce needs and being transparent and responsive. So we're not the best example to answer your question, basically, because for us, our operations are not impacted by these resolutions because our one single center that's kind of sort of associated with the conversation is not part of it. It's actually outside the resolutions. And even if it were inside the resolutions, we know that it is truly means student needs, not only for the veterans and Native American students, but more broadly. That's the best answer I can give you.
That's a great answer. Thank you. It's important for us to know the reality on all of our campuses. So thank you. President Green, University of Idaho.
Yes, thank you, President Clark. Let me start by saying, you know, I believe we always have supported all of our students, including, you know, we have mechanisms to identify when students run into academic trouble. And no matter what cohorts they're in, you know, we work to try to, you know, help them through that. But having said that, you know, these resolutions, which, you know, basically prohibit, you know, using personal characteristics such as race and gender, you know, do affect our programs. You know, our students highly affect, you know, highly value the programs that we've had. They've actively requested them, and we've seen success of these cohorts through their impact. These students often have a lot of the same issues, and they can help each other through them. And that's why those programs are there, and that's, you know, and the result is more students are making it through graduation because of them. You know, as you know, we've held 3 open meetings with our students directly affected by these changes. Their feedback, you know, does reflect a sense, a deep sense of loss and sadness about the closures. And additionally, our students and faculty have, as you mentioned, have provided their feedback to you. You know, but in short, you know, I think we all recognize the broader national and state political dynamics that our Board of Regents is addressing, and we are disappointed but not surprised that it's come to this given what's happened in other states. And I think Board Member Liebig made a great point about that, and I think we've all seen that. But as I've repeatedly said to our community, you know, we will always comply with board policy and state law in deed and spirit, and there are other cohort models. We have experience with others, such as our GAY program, that we reserve up to 100 seats for students who may not normally be accepted to the U of I, but have good, usually good reasons, a medical issue or you know, a tragedy in their family, something like that. And they have incredible success, despite the fact that they normally would not have been accepted to the U of I. So we know we can impact folks differently in different cohorts. And so we'll do the best that we can to continue to meet the needs of all of our students. We're setting up something called the Student Engagement Center, and with a particular focus on our first-generation student programming. And prioritizing our students and their success will remain central. It's really what we're all here for, and we will keep them in mind as we implement any directives from our Board of Regents and our legislature. So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, President Green.
Maybe before you pivot to the other ones, can I just slightly amend Kurt's question?
Of course.
Because I know what you're trying to get at, and I'm not sure you're getting the answer. You know, maybe put differently to the presidents, is there anything in these resolutions that you will have significant difficulty complying with and serving this all of the students in a way that meets their needs at this point? You know, you had the opportunity, each of you, to review these resolutions at this point. I maybe put it back. Is there anything that you see specifically in any of the 3? Maybe we're starting with the 1, but that you know, you would like to point out for us that's particularly problematic. Is that getting at what you're trying to?
Good Kurt? Question.
Simple one. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, we'll circle back around where we started. President Wagner, would you answer that question, please?
Yes, President Clark, members of the board, as we read the current resolution, first of all, we appreciate the iterative nature of the resolution itself. We've been supportive of the changes that have been made. We did have significant concerns with earlier versions and drafts of the resolution itself, specifically related to how we're serving our veteran students, how we're serving Native American students, even students with disabilities. And so I very, very much appreciate the process the board followed, the board office followed it through iterations to arrive at the location where they have. I do feel like the current state of the resolution itself does give us the room to do the work that we need to here at Idaho State to meet all of the needs of our students within the confines of the resolution itself. With the help of our institutional community members, we're going to do it, and we're going to serve students, and we're going to serve every student that comes to us, no matter who they are, what their needs are. We're going to help them, and we're going to make sure that they can succeed academically. So I do feel within the confines of the resolution itself and what's being created, we can meet the public mission that we have in serving students that come to us.
That was Idaho State University President Robert Wagner. You also heard in that clip from University of Idaho President C. Scott Green, Lewis Clark State College President Cynthia Pemberton, Boise State University President Marlene Tromp, and State Board of Education members Bill Gilbert and Eric Liebig. When we come back, we'll have some of the Pullman City Council's discussion on a proposed Israel-Gaza ceasefire resolution. This is the extended Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and Rembrandt Tree Care, family-owned and operated since 1977. A conscientious approach to urban forestry with year-round tree service on the Palouse and surrounding areas. You can reach Rembrandt Tree Care at 509-330-0699.
KRFP thanks all of its donors and underwriters for helping make this programming possible.
The majority of the Pullman City Council members indicated Tuesday night they do not want to move forward with a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and Israel. The proposal to pass the resolution came from council members Eric Fajerin and Carla De Lira, who had held public input sessions on the issue at Neal Public Library over the last few months and had engaged in other input gathering activities on the issue in the community. We'll start with Eric Fajerin, followed by discussion with the rest of the Pullman City Council members.
I just have a few remarks to kind of get the discussion going a little bit about the involvement of the community and then my personal input and my experience crafting this resolution, which I wrote in conjunction with the community and Councilmember De Lira. So on June 25th, I committed to working with Councilmember De Lira to draft a resolution in support of the ceasefire between Gaza and Israel. I just have a few remarks to kind of get the discussion going a little bit about the involvement of the community and then my personal input and my experience crafting this resolution, which I wrote in conjunction with the community and Councilmember De Lira. So on June 25th, I committed to working with Councilmember De Lira to draft a resolution in support of the ceasefire between Gaza and Israel. Since then, we've had many meetings and conversations with constituents, including two well-attended listening sessions at Neal Public Library, where our community came together to share diverse perspectives and engage in meaningful dialogue. In addition to that, I personally had countless conversations with constituents that have personally shaped my understanding of this issue and the broader role in municipal government in amplifying citizen voices. The resolution that we are here discussing today is a product of that ongoing work and collective input. I want to extend my sincere gratitude to Eric Wagner, who facilitated these thoughtful conversations, and everybody who participated in this process. It sounds like there may be concerns that this resolution stretches beyond the traditional responsibilities of City Council, and I hear tonight specifically how important it is to focus on local issues. However, in my view, I believe that our role as council members is not only to oversee infrastructure, its mission and its goals, but to represent the values and voices of Pullman residents. And representing people's voices go beyond the constraints of a mission and goals document. Pullman, personally, has always been a community that values inclusivity, compassion, and dialogue. I know this personally. When our constituents raise concerns, whether they be about unsafe intersections or humanitarian issues that extend beyond our borders, I feel, in my view, we have a responsibility to listen and act when appropriate. This resolution reflects the concerns of Pullman residents who have engaged passionately through public comment, listening sessions, and direct outreach. With this context in mind, I want to thank the City Council, and with that, let's begin our discussion.
With that, Councilmember De Lira, since you seconded, do you have any
comments?
Yeah, I think I've kind of made a lot of the remarks during my council member comments, but I think what I am most interested in is what everyone else on council thinks in terms of moving this forward.
With that, open Councilmember Weller.
I actually wrote something out this time. I'll just say I miss the days of talking about pigs and roundabouts. That was the most controversial stuff we talked about. You know, I've met with several people here. I appreciate Lita's and Matthew's community involvement. I want to thank everyone for speaking up, and both for and against the resolution. All of the emails, I think mine got somewhere around 20,000. Of course, not all from this community, as well as phone calls and talking to me at the gym, restaurants, grocery stores, and walking my dog. First, I'd like to explain that I feel no one is wrong or bad in this situation. There are just different opinions with our roles and powers as a city and what should or could be done. I'd also like to acknowledge both council members, Delira and Fajarin. This is a huge issue. This is a challenging issue, and I'm sure the listening sessions were difficult to put together. However, I must also acknowledge that many people did not attend because they were fearful to speak against it. Next, it's important to acknowledge the points for the resolution, which are as follows. Acknowledge and denounce the atrocities in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Don't allow our tax dollars to be used on weapons in the conflict. And 100 cities pass similar resolutions. We should as well. Those against say the council needs to focus on local matters, should not make decisions on foreign policy, and some have expressed that they feel it would show support to terrorist organizations. I hope that I have somewhat encapsulated both sides, but I know there are many, many more points. Here are some of my responses. This conflict has been going on since at least 1947. We have all seen the death and destruction in the media on both sides, and I fully understand the moral outrage for the killing of innocents. The U.S. provides weapons and aid to many countries, both in and out of conflicts. This is not just happening in the Middle East. I'm not saying I agree with it. That's what's happening. Brent had brought this up in email. But this is something that I had looked into. Yes, 100 cities, probably a little bit more now, have passed a ceasefire resolution of some type. But according to the census that I was looking at, there are over 19,500 incorporated areas, cities, towns, and so forth, which means that 0.5% of cities have passed something like this. In Washington, 7 cities have passed ceasefire declarations, Seattle back in 2023, of some type. However, there are 281 cities in Washington, which makes it at 2.5% that have ceasefire declarations. The council and city, I want to make sure to make this point, focuses not only on local issues, but regional, such as Palouse Basin water supply, and global matters, such as climate change. So it's not all just local. Next, I feel it's important to describe some of the separations of roles and responsibilities. The Department of State, and this is from the White House, the Department of State plays the lead role in developing and implementing the President's foreign policy. The Secretary of State serves as the President's top foreign policy advisor and oversees 30,000 employees and a budget of approximately $35 billion. Dollars to determine direction on policy. Experts in this field. The current U.S. policy is that the United States remains committed to advancing a comprehensive, negotiated, two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In local government, municipalities generally take responsibility for parks, recreation services, police, fire departments, housing, housing services, emergency medical, municipal courts, transportation, public works, enact laws and policies consistent with state law regulating local and municipal affairs. We make a difference in people's day-to-day lives. I think it is also important to remember our oath as council members, which is, in brief, I will faithfully and impartially discharge the duties of my office as prescribed by law and to the best of my ability, and will support and maintain all valid ordinances of the City of Pullman, the laws and the Constitution of the State of Washington, and of the United States of America. Don't get me wrong, this is an important topic, but there is a separation of governmental powers and roles. As was mentioned previously, we have elected representatives that can impact foreign affairs, which are currently President Biden, Vice President Harris, Senator Cantwell, Senator Murray, Congresswoman McMorris Rodgers. They can all be reached in various ways. Before closing, I believe there are some important questions to consider. How will this resolution impact our future as a city, especially in areas such as federal funding, when the new administration begins in the White House? Will it put a target on our back along with the other 100 cities? Why this conflict? Why not others? The Council on Foreign Relations is currently tracking at least 10 major conflicts. If we pass a resolution for this one, what about all of the others? Last, what is Pullman's role in the wider global community? If there is one, that is a good question to ask. Look, regardless of how the resolution is worded, it will be divisive. Anything referring to an international conflict, especially one that has had a long history of death and destruction on both sides, will make community groups feel isolated or fearful. It will not unite. It will divide along cultural and ideological lines. Lastly, local government is where the practical work gets done, not just words, but actions. It is part of our job to be nonpartisan and not bring conflicts here to our community and to our friends from all over the world who might be escaping those very same conflicts. I appreciate you listening.
Councilmember Parks.
Councilmember Weller said much of what I was going to say, but the first thing I really want to start out with is when we are elected, when I was elected, Mayor Johnson came into my office the next day, and the voice of the Cougs was asking for me. And he came into my office, and he sat down, and he said, "Congratulations on being elected to city council. You need to know that this is a nonpartisan board, and we leave all of our affiliations at the door. We do work for the public, for our residents, for all residents. We do not bring special interests to the city council dais." And I have adhered by that, and I believe in that, whether it's political or religious or some other similar issue. It isn't that we condone what's happening in Palestine as well as all of the other conflicts in the world. It's that this is not the place to address it and take a side. As Councilmember Weller indicated, this is a divisive issue. And one of our speakers said, looking back on this time, when we look back on this time, do we want to see that we divided our community or brought it together in unity, which another speaker also asked us to do? We've also been asked to build unity and to focus on city issues. By residents in this room, what you don't understand and what you do not know is that you may think that everybody in the city supports this resolution. They do not. there are other voices out there that we are not hearing publicly here in this room. I mean, we hear a few. We get so many messages and phone calls and stops at the gym or the grocery store saying, why are you doing this? What about, somebody mentioned Grand Avenue. What about the roads? What about, this is what, when people wake up in the morning, they want to know that they're going to have clean water, that the road is going to be plowed, that their child can go to the swimming pool today and it's going to be safe, among a myriad of other things. We want to make sure that all that happens, as well as supporting our staff, making sure they get paid, making sure they are taken care of. It is a multifaceted position that we in which we hold. And so when we hear things about, you know, we hope you are in favor of our shared values, of our common ground. You're speaking about people in your group and in this room, and that's completely fine. But I'm not comfortable assuming that those are the shared values and common ground that all of our residents feel about this. And for that reason, I maintain, again, that this is not the appropriate place. It isn't that we don't care. It isn't that we condone murder. It's that our job is to take care of everyone in our city, do what's best for the most, and help our staff. So, thank you.
Councilmember Guido.
Well, I want to thank everybody who came out and have spoken on this topic over the last several months, and the work of our two council members, Fajarin and Delira, for the work that you've done. I think it truly has been a process where we have heard from our folks in our community. I am not convinced I've, you know, personally heard from everyone. That's what we want, right? Is people to give their thoughts and to weigh in. And we've gotten hundreds, if not thousands, of letters or emails stating your thoughts around this resolution. What I have not necessarily appreciated was getting spammed by what is obviously a bot from a particular organization, where they're coming like every 20 seconds. Why I don't appreciate that is because it isn't a local organization. And to me, that's what this really boils down to, is it needs to be a local issue. And I do not believe this is an issue for this council to weigh in on because of many of the issues that have been brought up by fellow council members tonight. I have nothing against the language that's in the resolution. In fact, it's very hard to disagree with it. What I am concerned about is the precedent it sets. And where do we draw the line on how much we weigh in, or do we state our disapproval of numerous international conflicts that are going on. And as one gentleman said, you know, I would like a ceasefire in Ukraine, too. And where do we draw the line when we have so many other issues, local issues, that we have been elected and appointed to deal with? And we know that they're out there, and we know that the city needs addressing in a lot of different areas. This is not one of them.
Councilmember Gaither.
I don't even know where to begin. This is unique for not just us as a city, but for us as a nation. You know, we're used to dealing with one flashpoint at a time, one minoritized group being harmed at a time. one incident of racism at a time. We can all say, hey, this is wrong, but this is two minoritized groups at odds with one another. And organizations, institutions, cities, we're all looking around saying, okay, how do we handle this? This is new. I'm not against the ceasefire resolution. I don't want you, I've met with many of you as well. I'm not against the ceasefire resolution. I look at the report from Amnesty International that just came out. Yeah, my heart bleeds, right? And I get what you all are trying to do. This is a Hail Mary, right? Doing all that you can to save a life or to help someone live just one day longer, right? At least that's what I took from the conversations that I had with many of you. This is a Hail Mary. Then this isn't the only thing you're doing, and you're not going to stop doing this today. You're not going to stop doing this tomorrow. Amnesty International is a British NGO founded in 1961. It was founded by a British attorney, and they won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1977. And I just bring that up because I do want to mention their report. They came out with a report, and it concludes that they believe that Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Now, I said that I'm not against the resolution, but I think we must first establish clear principled policy to guide the city of Pullman in our decisions on making such statements in the future. We have to have it. We have to look at institutions across the country and how they're handling these situations because they keep coming up. They keep popping up, right? Institutions of higher ed, they've adopted the practice of maintaining institutional neutrality on divisive social or political issues. Washington State established a statement of institutional neutrality, right? It's a formalized process with clear criteria for making exceptions. When should we develop a policy to ensure consistency, fairness, and transparency in our decision making as a city? To my knowledge, now please correct me if I'm wrong, this would be the first time our city would be taking a stance on a major geopolitical or social issue. I don't believe the city issued a resolution for 9/11, for George Floyd, for Ukraine. So, as Councilmember Guido mentioned, where do we draw the line if we pass this resolution? And again, I'm saying I'm not against this resolution, but without a guiding framework, we do risk setting an unclear precedent. So it's important to determine under what circumstances we as a council break from neutrality. Is it when the issue directly and significantly impacts our community? Is it when there's an emergency or a natural disaster that threatens the function of our city? Or is it an issue like Gaza that demands immediate moral clarity? When is it? I know that you all are bringing this forward to us, and we've been thinking about this, and I think the one missed opportunity that, you know, I've brought up to one of my council members is we needed to talk about this during goal setting, because we could work together on this. I'm not against working together on this. We can work together with our legal counsel. We can work together with our city staff to establish first a clear policy so we can provide a reasoned and predictable process for approving not only this resolution, but future resolutions. whether in response to conflicts, natural disasters, or other events. That's just that we can't just think about. We can't just think about the moment, right? This would be setting a precedent. So my recommendation is this: if this is something that we want to continue, it's time to start talking to legal counsel staff and add this to our goals, one of our goals, to come up with a framework, a policy, to determine what circumstances we collectively speak on in regards to resolutions.
Councilmember Wright.
I can't really add much to what everyone has already spoken on here tonight. I would like to thank both Carla and Eric for the work that they did in putting this together, and I believe this was a very balanced and even-handed approach to the situation. Nathan, thank you for the research that you did on this, and Tremaine as well. You guys both did a fabulous job in bringing some good cogent points together. But again, I must take the stance of where does the city belong in this process? Again, that's not to deny that we don't all feel compassion and hope for the future ceasefire of this, but I don't know what we can do to affect that ceasefire where it would be of benefit to us to continue to make decisions as Tremaine indicated. What is the precedent? Where do we go with this? And again, if we look at this, we'd have to take the even-handed approach that this resolution is taking. Where do we stop? We have to look at every conflict, and that isn't what our job is. That isn't what we're supposed to be focusing on. And again, I thank you all for the work that you did and how well everything has been articulated. But I can't support this, not because I wouldn't personally support it, but because I can't support it in my role of city council person to make sure that we put forward all our goals and meet them as we have been asked to do by our citizens. So thank you all.
So with that, I hear pretty clear direction from council that they do not desire to move this forward. Councilmember DeLera?
Yeah, thank you everyone for your words and weighing in on this resolution. I personally believe that city government should be dynamic. I know that we are carefully looking at our mission statement and our goals and priorities, but there have been cities that, regardless of what their mission statement and their goals and priorities say, have chosen to weigh in on this issue. And it's not to say that other conflicts don't matter, but this is one issue that our community members have brought into light, and we are responding to that. And we know that it deeply affects people. So that's one thing I kind of want to push back on is we are responding to what our community wants, and that might not exactly be in the mission statement and the goals and priorities. And we have cities who have done the same thing, responded to a desire to weigh in on the conflict between Gaza and Israel.
And that was Pullman City Council member Carla DeLera. You just heard a discussion by the Pullman City Council Tuesday night on a proposal to move forward a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and Israel. As you heard, the council was not inclined to move forward with the resolution. The council voted 4-3 against a proposal for city legal staff to review the resolution, which would have been a step in the process of getting the council to vote on the resolution itself. The city council members you heard from were Eric Fajerin, who, along with Carla DeLera, had organized to move the resolution forward, Trimaine Gaither, Megan Guido, Ann Parks, Nathan Weller, and Pat Wright. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, 80% chance of rain tomorrow, mainly after 10 a.m., high 44, up to a quarter inch of rain possible. On Saturday night, 80% chance of rain before 10 p.m., snow level 4,900 feet, lowering to 4,200 feet after midnight, low 32. And on Sunday, partly sunny, high 42, with a 60% chance of rain after 4 p.m. mainly. Snow level 3,800 feet, rising to 4,500 feet in the afternoon. On Sunday night, 90% chance of rain. Snow level 5,100 feet, rising to 6,100 feet after midnight. Low 36, up to a quarter inch of rain possible. And a 30% chance of rain on Monday before 10 a.m. Snow level 5,000 feet, lowering to 4,400 feet, partly sunny, high 46. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. There you can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option. And there's also a Patreon button on the KRFP drop-down box. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox and Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant weekend. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is sponsored by Spectrum 2 Art and Dance Studios, specializing in art and dance classes for child
through adult. 525 South Main Street in Moscow. Information at 208-882-1445, UBU Dance Guru at msn.com, or spectrum2studio.com. For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.